Chapter 1. How I come not to have a last name is a question that has always had more or less aggravation mixed up with it. I might have had one just as well as not if old Hank Walters hadn't been so all-fired, infernal bullheaded about things in general, and his wife Elmira blamesite worse, and both of them ready to row at a minute's notice and stick to it forevermore. Hank, he was considerable of a lusher. One Saturday night, when he come home from the village in his usual fix, he stumbled over a basket that was setting on his front steps. Then he got up and drawed back his foot unsteady to kick it plumb into kingdom come. Just then he heard Elmira opening the door behind him, and he turned his head sudden. But the kick was already started into the air, and when he turns he can't stop it. And so Hank gets twisted and falls down and steps on himself. That basket lets out a yell. "It's kittens," says Hank, still sitting down and staring at that there basket. All of which, you understand, I am a telling you from hearsay, as the lawyers always eschew in court. "Elmira," she sings out. "Kittens, nothing. It's a baby." And she opens the basket and looks in, and it was me. "Henry Walters," she says, picking me up, and shaking me at him like I was a crime, "Henry Walters, where did you get this here baby?" She always calls him Henry when she is getting ready to give him fits. Hank, he scratches his head, for he's kinda confuddled, and thinks maybe he really has brought this basket with him. He tries to think of all the places he has been that night. But he can't think of any place but Bill Nolan's saloon. So he says, "Elmira, honest, I ain't had but one drink all day." And then he kinda rouses up a little bit, and gets surprised and says, "That a baby you got there, Elmira?" And then he says, dignified, "So fur as that's concerned, Elmira, where did you get that there baby?" She looks at him, and she sees he don't really know where I come from. Old Hank mostly was truthful when liquored up, for that matter, and she knowed it. Fur he couldn't think up no lies excepting a general denial when intoxicated up to the gills. Elmira looks into the basket. There was one of them long rubber tubes stringing out of a bottle that was in it, and I had been sucking that bottle when interrupted. And there wasn't nothing else in that basket but a big thick shawl which had been wrapped all around me, and Elmira often wore it to meeting afterward. She goes inside and she looks at the bottle and me by the light, and old Hank, he comes stumbling in afterward and sets down in a chair and waits to get Hail Columbia for coming home in that shape, so's he can row back again, like they done every Saturday night. Blowed in the glass of the bottle was the name, Daniel, Dunn, and Company. Anybody but them two old ignoramuses could have told right off that that didn't have nothing to do with me, but was just the company that made them kind of bottles. But she reads it out loud three or four times, and then she says, "His name is Daniel Dunn," she says. "And Company," says Hank, feeling right quarrelsome. "Company hain't no name," says she. "Why hain't it, I'd like to know," says Hank. "I knowed a man once it whose name was Farmer, and if a farmer's a name why ain't a company a name too?" "His name is Daniel Dunn," says Elmira, quiet-like, but not dodging a row, neither. "And Company," says Hank, getting on to his feet, like he always done when he seen trouble coming. When old Hank was full of liquor he knowed just the ways to aggravate her the worst. She might have banged him one the same as usual, and got her own eye blacked also, the same as usual, but just then I lets out another big yowl, and she give me some milk. I guess the only reason they ever kept me at first was so they could quarrel about my name. They'd lived together a good many years and quarreled about everything else under the sun, and was running out of subjects. A new subject kinda briskened things up for a while. But finally they went too far with it one time. I was about 2 years old then and he was still calling me Company and her calling me Dunn. This time he hits her a lick that lays her out and likes to kill her, and it gets him scared. But she gets around again after a while, and they both see it has went too fur the time, and so they makes up. "Elmira, I give in," says Hank. "His name is Dunn." "No," says she, tender-like, "you was right, Hank. His name is Company." So they pretty near got into another row over that. But they finally made it up between them I didn't have no last name, and they'd just call me Danny. Which they both done faithful ever after, as agreed. Old Hank, he was a blacksmith, and he used to lamb me considerable, him and his wife not having any kids of their own to lick. He lammed me when he was drunk, and he whaled me when he was sober. I never held it up again him much, neither, not for a good many years, because he got me used to it young. And I hadn't never knowed nothing else. Hank's wife, Elmira, she used to lick him just about as often as he licked her, and boss him just as much. So he fell back on me. A man has just naturally got to have something to cuss around and boss, so's to keep himself from finding out he don't amount to nothing. Leastways, most men is like that. And Hank, he didn't amount to much, and he kinda knowed it, way down deep in his inmost gizzards, and it were a comfort to him to have me around. But there was one thing he never sought no store by, and I got along now to where I hold that up agin him more'n all the lickings he ever done. That was book learning. He never had none himself, and he was sought agin it, and he never made me get none, and if I'd ever stood him for any he'd have whaled me fur that. Hank's wife, Elmira, had married beneath her, and everybody in our town had come to see it, and used to sympathize with her about it when Hank wasn't around. She'd tell him, yes, it was so. Back in Elmira, New York, from which her father and mother come to our part of Illinois in the early days, her father had kept a hotel, and they was stylish kind of folks. When she was born her mother was homesick for all that style and for York State ways, and so she named her Elmira. But when she married Hank, he had considerable land. His father had left it to him, but it was all swamp land, and so Hank's father, he hunted more and he farmed, and Hank and his brothers done the same when he was a boy. But Hank, he learned a little blacksmithing when he was growing up, cause he liked to tinker around and to show how stout he was. Then, when he married Elmira Appleton, he had to go to work practicing that profession regular, because he never learned nothing about farming. He'd sell 15 or 20 acres, every now and then, and they'd be high times till he'd spent it up, and maybe Elmira would get some new clothes. But when I was found on the doorstep, the land was all gone, and Hank was practicing regular, when not busy cussing out the fellers that had bought the land. For some smart fellers had come along, and bought up all that swamp land and dreamed it, and now it was worth $70 or $80 an acre. Hank, he figured someone had cheated him. Which the Walterses could have dreamed then too, only they'd rooter hunt ducks and have fish fries than to dig ditches. All of which I heard Elmira talking over with the neighbors more than once when I was growing up, and they all says, how sad it is you have came to this, Elmira. And then she'd kinda spunk up and say, thanks to glory, she'd kept her pride. Well, they was worse places to live in than at their little town, even if they wasn't no railroad within 8 miles, and only 300 souls in the hull corporation. Which Hank's shop and our house set in the edge of the woods just outside the corporation line, so's the city marshal didn't have no authority to arrest him after he crossed it. There was one thing in that house I always admired when I was a kid. And that was a big cistern. Most people has their cisterns outside their house, and they is a tin pipe takes all the rain water off the roof and scoots it into them. Urn worked the same, but our cistern was right in under our kitchen floor, and there was a trap door with leather hinges opened into it right by the kitchen stove. But that wasn't why I was so proud of it. It was because that cistern was just plumb full of fish bullheads and red horse and sunfish and other kinds. Hank's father had built that cistern. And one time he brung home some live fish in a bucket and dumped him in there. And they growed. And they multiplied in there and refurnished the earth. So that cistern had got to be a family custom, which was kept up in that family for a habit. It was a great comfort to Hank, for all them Walterses was great fish eaters, though it never went to brains. We fed him now and then, and throwed back in the little ones till they was growed, and kept the dead ones picked out soon's we smelled anything wrong, and it never hurt the water none, and when I was a kid I wouldn't have took anything for living in a house like that. Once it, when I was a kid about 6 years old, Hank come home from the bar room. He got to chasing Elmira's cat cause he says it was making faces at him. The cistern door was open, and Hank fell in. Elmira was over to town, and I was scared. She had always told me not to fool around there none when I was a little kid, for if I fell in there I'd be a corpse quicker and scat. So when Hank fell in, and I heard him splash, being only a little feller, and awful scared because Elmira had always made it so strong, I hadn't no sort of unbelief but what Hank was a corpse already. So I slams the trap door shut over that their cistern without looking in, for I heard Hank flopping around down in there. I hadn't never heard a corpse flop before, and didn't know but what it might be somehow injurious to me, and I wasn't going to take no chances. So I went out and played in the front yard, and waited for Elmira. But I couldn't seem to get my mind settled on playing I was a horse, nor nothing. I kept thinking maybe Hank's corpse is going to come flopping out of that cistern and whale me some unusual way. I hadn't never been licked by a corpse, and didn't rightly know just what one is, anyhow, being young and comparative innocent. So I sneaks back in and sets all the flat irons in the house on top of the cistern lid. I heard some flopping and splashing and sputtering, like Hank's corpse is trying to jump up and is falling back into the water, and I heard Hank's voice, and got scareder yet. And when Elmira come along down the road, she seen me by the gate a-crying, and she asked me why. Hank is a corpse, says I, blubbering. A corpse, says Elmira, dropping her coffee which she was carrying home from the general store and post office. "Danny, what do you mean?" I seen I was to blame somehow, and I wished that I hadn't said nothing about Hank being a corpse. And I made up my mind I wouldn't say nothing more. So when she grabs hold of me and asks me again what did I mean, I blubbered harder, just the way a kid will, and says nothing else. I wished I hadn't set them flat irons on that door, for it come to me all at once that even if Hank has turned into a corpse, I ain't got any right to keep him in that cistern. Just then old Miss Rogers, which is one of our neighbors, comes by, while Elmira is shaking me and yelling out what did I mean and how did it happen and had I saw it and where was Hank's corpse. And Miss Rogers, she says, "What's Danny been doing now, Elmira?" Me being always up to something. Elmira, she turned around and seen her, and she gives a whoop and then hollers out, "Hank is dead," and throws her apron over her head and sets right down in the path and boo-hoos like a baby. And I bellers louder. Miss Rogers, she never waited to ask nothing more. She seen she had a piece of news, and she's bound to be the first to spread it, like they's always a lot of women wants to be in them country towns. She run right across the road to where the Alexanderses lived. Miss Alexander, she seen her coming and unhooked the screen door, and Miss Rogers, she hollers out before she reached the porch, "Hank Walters is dead." And then she went footing it up the street. There was a black plume on her bonnet which nodded the same as on a hearse, and she was into and out of 7 front yards in 5 minutes. Miss Alexander, she runs across the street to where we was, and she kneels down and puts her arm around Elmira, which was still rocking back and forth in the path, and she says, "How do you know he's dead, Elmira? I seen him not more'n an hour ago." "Danny seen it all," says Elmira. Miss Alexander turned to me, and wants to know what happened and how it happened and where it happened. But I don't want to say nothing about that cistern. So I busts out bellering fresher than ever, and I says, "He was drunk, and he come home drunk, and he done it then, and that's how he done it," I says. "And you seen him?" she says. I nodded. "Where is he?" says she and Elmira, both to once it. But I was scared to say nothing about that there cistern, so I just bawled some more. "Was it in the blacksmith shop?" says Miss Alexander. I nodded my head again and let it go at that. "Is he in there now?" asks Miss Alexander. I nodded again. I hadn't meant to give out no untrue stories. But a kid will always tell a lie, not meaning to tell one, if you sort of invite him with questions like that, and get him scared the way you're acting. Besides, I says to myself, so long as Hank has turned into a corpse and that makes him dead, what's the difference whether he's in the blacksmith shop or not? For I hadn't had any plain idea, being such a little kid, that a corpse meant to be dead, and wasn't sure what being dead was like, neither, except they had funerals over you then. I knowed being a corpse must be some sort of a big disadvantage from the way Elmire always says keep away from that cistern door or I'll be one. But if they was going to be a funeral in our house, I'd feel kinda important, too. They didn't have them every day in our town, and we hadn't never had one of our own. So Miss Alexander, she led Elmira into the house, both a crying, and Miss Alexander trying to comfort her, and me a tagging along behind holding on to Elmira's skirts and sniffling into them. And in a few minutes all them women Miss Rogers has told come filing into that room, one at a time, looking sad. Only old Miss Primrose, she was awful late getting there because she stopped to put on her bonnet she always wore to funerals with the black Paris lace on it her cousin Armandy Wyatt had sent her from Chicago. When they found out Hank had come home with liquor in him and done it himself, they was all excited, and they all crowds around and asks me how, except who is as holding onto Elmira's hands which sets moaning in a chair. And they all asks me questions as to what I seen him do, which if they hadn't I wouldn't have told them the lies I did. But they egged me onto it. Says one woman, "Danny, you seen him do it in the blacksmith shop?" I nodded. "But how did he get in?" sings out another woman. "The door was locked on the outside with a padlock just now when I come by. He couldn't have killed himself in there and locked the door on the outside. I didn't see how he could have done that myself, so I begun to bawl again and said nothing at all." "He must have crawled through that little side window," says another one. "It was open when I come by, if the door was locked. Did you see him crawl through the little side window, Danny?" I nodded. There wasn't nothing else for me to do. "But you ain't tall enough to look through that there window," says another one to me. "How could you see into that shop, Danny?" I didn't know, so I didn't say nothing at all, I just sniffled. "There is a store box right in under that window," says another one. "Danny must have clumb onto that store box and looked in after he seen Hank come down the road and crawl through the window. Did you scramble onto the store box and look in, Danny? I just nodded again. And what was it you seen him do? How did he kill himself? They all asked to wants it. _I_ didn't know. So I just bellers and boo-hoos some more. Things was getting past anything I could see the way out of. He might have hung himself to one of the iron rings in the gists above the forge, says another woman. He clung onto the forge to tie the rope to one of them rings, and he tied the other end around his neck, and then he stepped off on the forge. Was that how he done it, Danny? I nodded. And then I bellered louder than ever. I knowed Hank was down in that there cistern, a corpse and a mighty wet corpse, all this time, but they kinda got me to thinking maybe he was hanging out in the shop by the forge, too. And I guessed I'd better stick to the shop story, not wanting to say nothing about that cistern no sooner and I could help it. Pretty soon one woman says, kinda shivery. I don't want to have the job of opening the door of that blacksmith shop the first one. And they all kinda shivered then, and looked at Elmira. They says to let some of the men open it. And Miss Alexander, she says she'll run home and tell her husband right off. And all the time Elmira is moaning in that chair. One woman says Elmira ordered her have a cup of tea, which she'll lay off her bonnet and go to the kitchen and make it for her. But Elmira says no, she can't a bear to think of tea, with poor Henry A. hanging out there in the shop. But she was kinda enjoying all that fuss being made over her, too. And all the other women says. Poor thing. But all the same they was mad she said she didn't want any tea, for they all wanted some and didn't feel free without she took it too. Which she said she would after they'd coaxed a while and made her see her duty. So they all goes out to the kitchen, bringing along some of the best room chairs, Elmira coming too, and me tagging along behind. And the first thing they noticed was them flat irons on top of the cistern door. Miss Primrose, she says that looks funny. But another woman speaks up and says Danny must have been playing with them while Elmira was over town. She says, was you playing they was horses, Danny? I was feeling considerable like a liar by this time, but I says I was playing horses with them, for I couldn't see no use in hurrying things up. I was bound to get a lambing pretty soon anyhow. When I was a kid I could always bet on that. So they picks up the flat irons, and as they picks them up they come a splashing noise in the cistern. I thinks to myself, Hank's corpse'll be out of there in a minute. One woman, she says. Goodness gracious sakes alive. What's that, Elmira? Elmira says that cistern is mighty full of fish, and they is some great big ones in there, and it must be some of them a flopping around. Which if they hadn't have been all worked up and talking all to once it and all thinking of Hank's body hanging out there in the blacksmith shop they might have suspicioned something. For that flopping kept up steady, and a lot of splashing too. I maybe heard her mention sooner it had been a dry summer and there was only 3 or 4 feet of water in our cistern, and Hank wasn't in scarcely up to his big hairy chest. So when Elmira says the cistern is full of fish, that woman opens the trapdoor and looks in. Hank thinks it's Elmira come to get him out. He allows he'll keep quiet in there and make believe he is drowned and give her a good scare and make her sorry for him. But when the cistern door is opened, he hears a lot of clacking tongues all of a sudden like they was a hen convention on. He allows she has told some of the neighbors, and he'll scare them too. So Hank, he laid low. And the woman as looks and sees nothing, for it's as dark down there as the insides of the whale what swallowed Noah. But she leaves the door open and goes on a making tea, and they ain't scarcely a sound from that cistern, only little, ripply noises like it might have been fish. Pretty soon a woman says. It has drawed, Elmira, won't you have a cup? Elmira she kicked some more, but she took hern. And each woman took hern. And one woman, a sipping of hern, she says. The departed had his good pints, Elmira. Which was the best thing had been said of Hank in that town for years and years. Old Miss Primrose, she always prided herself on being honest, no matter what come, and she ups and says. I don't believe in no hypocritics at a time like this, no more and no other time. The departed wasn't no good, and the whole town knowed it, and Elmira heard her feel like it's good riddance of bad rubbish in them is my sentiments and the sentiments of rightfulness. All the other women sings out. Why, Miss Primrose? I never. And they seemed awful shocked. But down and underneath more of them agreed than let on. Elmira she wiped her eyes and she said. Henry and me has had our troubles. They ain't any use in denying that. Miss Primrose. It has often been give and take between us and betwixt us. And the whole town knows he has lifted his hand again me more and wants it. But I always stood up to Henry, and I fit him back, free and fair and open. I give him as good as he sent on this here earth, and I ain't the one to carry no animosities beyond the grave. I forgive Hank all the orneriness he done me, And there was a lot of it, as is becoming unto a church member, which he never was. And all the women but Miss Primrose, they says. Elmira Appleton, you have got a Christian spirit. Which done her a heap of good, and she cried considerable harder, leaking out tears as fast as she poured tea in. Each one on them tries to find out something good to say about Hank, only there wasn't much they could say. And Hank and that their sister nay listening to every word of it. Miss Rogers, she says. Afore he took to drinking like a fish, Hank Walters was as likely looking a young feller as I ever see. Miss White, she says. Well, Hank he never was a stingy man, nohow. Often and often White has told me about seeing Hank, after he'd sold a piece of land, treating the whole town down in Nolan's barroom just as come easy, go easy as if it wasn't money he earned or paid his honest debts with. They sat there that away telling of what good pints they could think of for 10 minutes, and Hank a-hearing it and getting madder and madder all the time. The general opinion was that Hank wasn't no good and was better done for, and no matter what they said them feelings kept sticking out through the words. By and by Tom Alexander come busting into the house, and his wife, Miss Alexander, was with him. What's the matter with all you folks, he says. They ain't nobody hanging in that there blacksmith shop. I broke the door down and went in, and it was empty. Then there was a pretty howdy-do, and they all sings out. Where's the corpse? And some thinks maybe someone has cut it down and took it away, and all gabbles to once it. But for a minute no one thinks maybe little Danny has been egged on to tell lies. Little Danny ain't saying a word. But Elmira she grabs me and shakes me and she says. You little liar, you, what do you mean by the tale you told? I thinks that lambing is about due now. But whilst all eyes is turned on me and Elmira, there comes a voice from that cistern. It is Hank's voice, and he sings out. Tom Alexander, is that you? Some of the women scream, for some thinks it is Hank's ghost. But one woman says what would a ghost be doing in a cistern? Tom Alexander, he laughs and he says. What in blazes you want to jump in there for, Hank? You durn it. Says Hank, you quit mocking me and get a ladder, and when I get out in here I'll learn you to ask what did I want to jump in here for. You never seen the day you could do it, says Tom Alexander, meaning the day he could lick him. And if you feel that way about it you can stay there for all of me. I guess a little water won't hurt you none. And he left the house. Elmira, sings out Hank, mad and bossy, you go get me a ladder. But Elmira, her temper riz up too, all of a sudden. Don't you dare order me around like I was the dirt under your feet, Henry Walters, she says. At that Hank fairly roared, he was so mad. He says. Elmira, when I get out in here I'll give you what you want virgin in a hurry. I hearn you a forgiving me and a weeping over me, and I won't be forgive nor weeped over by no one. You go and get that ladder. But Elmira only answers. You wasn't sober when you fell into there, Henry Walters. And now you can just stay in there till you get a better temper on you. And all the women says, that's right, Elmira, spunk up to him. There was considerable splashing around in the water for a couple of minutes. And then, all of a sudden, a live fish come a whirling out of that hole, which he had catched it with his hands. It was a big bullhead, and its whiskers around its mouth was stiffened into spikes, and it lands kerplump into Miss Rogers's lap, a wiggling, and it kinda horns her on the hands, and she is that surprised she faints. Miss Primrose, she gets up and pushes that fish back into the cistern with her foot from the floor where it had fell, and she says right decided. Elmira Walters, that was Elmira Appleton, if you let Hank out in that cistern before he has signed the pledge and promised to join the church you're a bigger fool than I take you to be. A woman has got to make a stand. With that she marches out in our house. Then all the women sings out. Send for Brother Cartwright. Send for Brother Cartwright. And they sent me scooting across town to get him quick. Which he was the preacher of the Baptist church and lived next to it. And I hadn't got no lambing yet. Chapter 2. I never stopped to tell but 2, 3 folks on the way to Brother Cartwright's, but they must have spread it quick. 'Cause when I got back home with him it seemed like the whole town was there. It was along about dusk by this time, and it was a prayer meeting night at the church. Mr. Cartwright told his wife to tell the folks what come to the prayer meeting he'd be back before long, and to wait for him. Which she really told them where he had went, and what for. Mr. Cartwright marches right into the kitchen. All the chairs in our house was into the kitchen, and the women was a talking and a laughing, and they had set over to Alexander's for their chairs and to Rogers's for theirn. Every once in a while they would be awful bust of language come up from that hole where that unregenerate old sinner was cooped up in. I have traveled around considerable since them days, and I have mixed up along of many kinds of people in many different places, and some of them was cussers to admire. But I never heard such cussing before or since as old Hank done that night. He busted his own records and riz higher in his own watermarks for previous times. I wasn't nothing but a little kid then, and skirkly fit and fur to admire the full beauty of it. They was deep down cusses, that come from the heart. Looking back at it after all these years, I can believe what Brother Cartwright said himself that night, that it wasn't natural cussing in some higher power, like a demon or a evil spirit, must have entered into Hank's human carcass and give the terrible eloquence to his remarks. It busted out every few minutes, and the women would put their fingers into their ears till a spell was over. And it was personal, too. Hank, he would listen until he heard a woman's voice that he knowed, and then he would let loose on her family, going backwards to her grandfather's and downwards to her children's children. If her father had once stolen a hog, or her husband done any disgrace that got found out on him, Hank would put it all into his general remarks, with trimmings onto it. Brother Cartwright, he steps up to the hole in the floor when he first comes in and he says, gentle-like and soothing, like a undertaker when he tells you where to set at a home funeral. Brother Walters. Brother. Hank yells out, don't ye brother me, you sniffling, psalm singing, you all-faced, pigeon-toed hypocrite, you. Get me a ladder, gold earn you, and I'll come out in here and learn you to brother me, I will. Only that wasn't nothing to what Hank really said to that preacher, no more like it than a little yaller, fluffy canary is like a buzzard. Brother Walters, says the preacher, calm but firm, we have all decided that you ain't going to come out of that cistern till you sign the pledge. And Hank tells him what he thinks of pledges and him and church doings, and it wasn't pretty. And he says if he was as deep in eternal fire as what he now is in rainwater, and every fish that nibbles at his toes was a preacher with a red-hot pitchfork jabbing at him, they could jab till the whole hereafter turned into snow afore he'd ever sign nothing a man like Mr. Cartwright give him to sign. Hank was stubborner than any mule he ever nailed shoes onto, and proud of being that stubborn. That town was awful religious town, and Hank he knowed he was called the most unreligious man in it, and he was proud of that too, and if anyone called him a heathen it just plumb tickled him all over. Brother Walters, says that preacher, we are going to pray for you. And they done it. They brought all them chairs close up around that cistern, in a ring, and they all kneeled down there, with their heads on him, and they prayed for Hank's salvation. They done it up in style, two, one at a time, and the others singing out, Amen. Every now and then, and they shed tears down onto Hank. The front yard was crowded with men, all a laughing and a talking and chawing and spitting tobacco and betting how long Hank would hold out. Old C. Emery, that was the city marshal, and always wore a big nickel-plated star, was out there with him. C. was in a sweat, 'cause Bill Nolan, that run the barroom, and some more of Hank's friends, or as near friends as he had, was out in the road. They says to C. he must arrest that preacher, for Hank is being gradual murdered in that there water, and he'll die if he's held there too long, and it will be a crime. Only they didn't come into the yard to say it amongst us religious folks. But C., he says he dasn't arrest no one because it is outside the town corporation, but he's considerable worried too about what his duty orter be. Pretty soon the gang that Mrs. Cartwright has rounded up at the prayer meeting come stringing along in. They had all brung their hymn books with them, and they sung. The whole town was there then, and they all sung, and they sung revival hymns over Hank. And Hank he would just cuss and cuss. Every time he busted out into another cussing spell they would start another hymn. Finally the men out in the front yard got warmed up too, and begun to sing, all but Bill Nolan's crowd, and they give Hank up for lost and went away disgusted. The first thing you knowed there was a regular revival meeting there, and that preacher was preaching a regular revival sermon. I'd been to more'n one camp meeting, but for just naturally taking holt of the whole human race by the slack of its pants and dangling of it over hellfire, I never heard nothing could come up to that there sermon. Two or three old backsliders in the crowd come right up and repented all over again on the spot. The whole kit and biling of 'em got the power good and hard, like they does at camp meetings and revivals. But Hank, he only cussed. He was obstinate, Hank was, and his pride and dander had riz up. Finally he says, you're taking a ornery, low-down advantage of me, you are. Let me out in this here cistern and I'll show you who'll stick it out longest on dry land, durn your religious hides. Some of the folks there hadn't had no suppers, so after all the other sinners but Hank had either got converted or else sneaked away, some of the women says why not make a kind of love feast out of it, and bring some victuals, like they does to church sociables. Because it seems likely Satan is going to wrestle all night long, like he done with the angel Jacob, and they ought to be prepared. So they done it. They went and they come back with victuals and they made up hot coffee and they feasted that preacher and theirselves and Elmira and me, all right in Hank's hearing. And Hank was getting hungry himself. And he was cold in that water. And the fish was nibbling at him. And he was getting cussed out and weak and soaked full of despair. And there wasn't no way for him to set down and rest. And he was scared of getting a cramp in his legs, and sinking down with his head underwater and being drowned. He said afterward he'd have done the last with pleasure if there was any way of suing that crowd for murder. So along about 10 o'clock he sings out. I give in, gosh darn ye. I give in. Let me out and I'll sign your pesky pledge. Brother Cartwright was for getting a ladder and letting him climb out right away. But Elmira, she says. Don't you do it, Brother Cartwright, don't you do it. You don't know Hank Walters like I does. If he once it gets out of there before he signed that pledge, he won't never sign it. So they fixed it up that Brother Cartwright was to write out a pledge on the inside leaf of the Bible, and tie the Bible onto a string, and a lead pencil onto another string, and let the strings down to Hank, and he was to make his mark, for he couldn't write, and they was to be pulled up again. Hank, he says all right, and they done it. But just as Hank was making his mark on the leaf of the book, that preacher done what I has always thought was a mean trick. He was lying on the floor with his head and shoulders into that hole as fur as he could, holding a lantern way down into it, so as Hank could see. And just as Hank made that mark he spoke some words over him, and then he says, Now, Henry Walters, I have baptized you, and you are a member of the church. You'd have thought Hank would have broke out cussing again at being took unexpected that away, for he hadn't really agreed to nothing but signing the pledge. But nary a cuss. He just says, Now, you get that ladder. They got it, and he clumb up into the kitchen, dripping and shivering. You went and baptized me in that water? He asks the preacher. The preacher says he has. Then, says Hank, you done a low-down trick on me. You knowed I has made my brags I never jined no church nor never would jind. You knowed I was proud of that. You knowed that it was my glory to tell of it, and that I set a heap of store by it in every way. And now you've went and took it away from me. You never fought it out fair and square, neither, man playing to outlast man, like you done with this here pledge, but you sneaked it in on me when I wasn't looking. There was a lot of men in that crowd that thought the preacher had went too far, and sympathized with Hank. The way he done about that hurt Brother Cartwright in our town, and there was a split in the church, because some said it wasn't regular and wasn't binding. He lost his job after a while and become an evangelist. Which it don't make no difference what one of them does, nohow. But Hank, he always thought he had been baptized regular. And he never was the same afterward. He had made his lifelong brags, and his pride was broken that there one particular spot. And he sorriered and grieved over it a good deal, and got grouchier and grouchier and meaner, and liquored oftener, if anything. Signing the pledge couldn't hold Hank. He was worse in every way after that night in the cistern, and took to lambing me harder and harder. Chapter 3. Well, all the lambings Hank laid on never done me any good. It seemed like I was just naturally cut out to have no success in life, and no amount of wailing could change it, though Hank, he was faithful. Before I was 12 years old the whole town had seen it, and there wasn't nothing else expected of me except not to be any good. That had its handy sides to it, too. There was lots of kids there that had to go to school, but Hank, he never would have let me done that if I had asked him, and I never asked. And there was lots of kids considerably bothered all the time with their parents and relations. They made him go to Sunday school, and wash up regular all over on Saturday nights, and put on shoes and stockings part of the time, even in the summer, and some of them had to ask to go in swimming, and the whole thing was a continuous trouble and privation to him. But there wasn't nothing predicted of me, and I done like it was predicted. Everybody lowed from the start that Hank would have made trash out on me, even if I hadn't showed all the signs of being trash anyhow. And if they was devilment anywhere about that town they all says, Danny, he done it. And like as not I has. So I gets to be what you might call an outcast. All the kids whose folks ain't trash, their mothers tells them not to run with me no more. Which they done it all the more for that reason, on the sly, and it makes me more important with them. But when I gets a little bigger, all that makes me feel kinda bad sometimes. It ain't so handy then. For folks gets to saying, when I would come around. Danny, what do you want? And if I says, nothing, they would say. Well, then, you get out of here. Which they needn't have been suspicioning nothing like they pretended they did, for I never stole nothing more in butter millions and mush millions and such truck, and maybe now and then a chicken us kids used to roast in the woods on Sundays, and just as like as not it was one of Hank's hens then, which I figured I'd earn it. For Hank, he had streaks when he'd worked me considerable hard. He never give me any money for it. He loafed a lot too, and when he loaf I loaf. But I did pick up right smart of handiness with tools around that there shop of his, and if he'd ever have used me right I might have turned into a pretty fair blacksmith. But it wasn't no use trying to work for Hank. When I was about 15, times is right bad around the house for a spell, and Elmira is working pretty hard, and I thinks to myself, well, these folks has kinda brung you up, and you ain't never done more'n Hank made you do. Maybe you orter stick to work a little more when they's a job in the shop, even if Hank don't. Which I tried it for about 2 or 3 years, doing as much work around the shop as Hank done and maybe more. But it wasn't no use. One day when I'm about 18, I seen awful plain I'll have to light out from there. They was a circus come to town that day. I says to Hank, Hank, they is a circus this afternoon and again tonight. So I has hern, says Hank. Are you going to it? Says I. I moot, says Hank, and then again I mootn't. I don't see as it's no concerns of yourn, no how. I knowed he was going, though. Hank, he never missed a circus. Well, I says, they wasn't no harm to ast, was they? Well, you visited, ain't you? Says Hank. Well, then, says I, I'd like to go to that there circus myself. They ain't no use in me saying for you not to go, says Hank, for you would go anyhow. You always does go off when you is needed. But I ain't got no money, I says, and I was going to ask you could you spare me half a dollar? Great Jehoshaphat, says Hank, but ain't you getting stuck up? What's the matter of you crawling in under the tent like you always done? First thing I know you'll be wanting a pair of these here yaller shoes and a stovepipe hat. No, says I ain't no dude, Hank, and you know it. But they is always things about a circus to spend money on besides just the circus herself. They is the sideshow, for instance, and they is the grand concert afterward. I calculated I'd take them all in this year the whole darn thing, just for once it. Hank, he looks at me like I'd a stood for a house and lot, or $1 million, or something like that. But he don't say nothing. He just snorts. Hank, I says, I been doing right smart work around the shop for 2, 3 years now. If you wasn't loafing so much you'd have noticed it more. And I ain't never asked for a cent of pay for it, nor. You ain't want no pay, says Hank. You ain't want nothing but to eat victuals and wear out clothes. Well, I says, I figure I earn my victuals and a good deal more. And as for as clothes goes, I never had none but what Elmira made out in yourn. Who brung you up? Us Hank. You done it, says I, and by your own say so you done a darn poor job at it. You go to that there circus, says Hank, a flaring up, and I'll lambaste you up to a inch of your life. So for as handing out money for you to sling it to the dogs, I ain't no bank, and if I was I ain't no id. But you just let me hear of you even going nigh that circus lot and all the lemmings you has ever got, rolled into one, won't be a measly little circumstance to what you will get. They ain't no leather-faced young upstart with weepin' willow hair going to throw up to me how I brung him up. That's gratitude for you, that is. Says Hank. If it hadn't have been for me giving you a home when I found you first, where would you have been now? Well, I says, I might have been a good deal better off. If you hadn't have took me in the Alexanderses would have, and then I wouldn't have been kept out of school and growed up ignoramus like you is. I never had no trouble keeping you away from school, I notice, says Hank, with a snort. This is the first I ever heard of you wanting to go there. Which was true in one way, and a lie in another. I hadn't never wanted to go till lately, but he'd have lammed me if I had have wanted to. He always said he would. And now I was too big and knowed it. Well, Hank, he never give me no money, so I watches my chance at that afternoon and slips in under the tent the same as always. And I lays low under them green benches and wiggled through when I seen a good chance at. The first person I seen was Hank. Of course he seen me, and he shook his fist at me in a promising kind of way, and they wasn't no trouble figuring out what he meant. For a while I didn't enjoy that circus to no extent. For I was thinking that if Hank tries to lick me for it I'll fight him back this time, which I hadn't never fit him back much yet for fear he'd pick up something iron around the shop and just naturally lay me cold with it. I got home before Hank did. It was nigh sundown, and I was waiting in the door of the shop for Elmira to holler victuals is ready, and Hank come along. He didn't waste no time. He steps inside the shop and he takes down a strap and he says, you come here and take off your shirt. But I just moves away. Hank, he runs in on me, and he swings his strap. I throwed up my arm, and it cut me across the knuckles. I run in on him, and he dropped the strap and fetched me an open-handed smack plumb on the mouth that jarred my head back and like to have busted it loose. Then I got right mad, and I run in on him again, and this time I got to him, and wrestled with him. Well, sir, I never was so surprised in all my life before. For I hadn't had holt on him more'n a minute before I seen I'm stronger than Hank is. I throwed him, and he hit the ground with considerable of a jar, and then I put my knee in the pit of his stomach and turned it a couple. And I thinks to myself what a fool I must have been for better in a year, because I might have done this any time. I got him by the ears and I slammed his head into the gravel a few times, him a reaching for my throat, and a pounding me with his fists, but me a taking the licks and keeping hold. And I had a mighty contented time for a few minutes there on top of Hank, chuckling to myself, and batting him one every now and then for luck, and trying to make him holler it's enough. But Hank is stubborn and he won't holler. And pretty soon I thinks, what am I going to do? For Hank will be so mad when I let him up he'll just naturally kill me, without I kill him. And I was scared, because I don't want neither one of them things to happen. Whilst I was thinking it over, and getting scareder and scareder, and banging Hank's head harder and harder, someone grabs me from behind. There was two of them, and one gets my collar and one gets the seat of my pants, and they drug me off in him. Hank, he gets up, and then he sets down sudden on a horse block and wipes his face on his sleeve, which there was considerable blood come onto the sleeve. I looks around to see who has had holt of me, and it is two men. One of them looks about 7 feet tall, on account of a big plug hat and a long white linen duster, and has a beautiful red beard. In the road there is a big stout road wagon, with a canopy top over it, pulled by two horses, and on the wagon box there is a strip of canvas. Which I couldn't read then what was wrote on the canvas, but I learnt later it said, in big print, Siwash Indian Sagraw. Nature's Universal Medicinal Specific. Discovered by Dr. Hartley L. Kirby among the Aborigines of Oregon. On account of being so busy, neither Hank nor me had heard the wagon come along the road and stop. The big man in the plug hat, he says, or there was words to that effect, just as serious. Why are you mauling the aged gent? Well, says I, he needed it considerable. But, says he, still more solemn, the good book says to honor thy father and thy mother. Well, I says, mebbe it does and mebbe it don't. But he ain't my father, nohow. And he ain't been getting no more in his come-uppings. Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord, the big man remarks, very serious. Hank, he riz up then, and he says, Mister, be you a preacher? 'Cause if you be, the sooner you have druv on, the better for ye. I got a grudge agin all preachers. That feller, he just looks Hank over CAM and easy and slow before he answers, and he wrinkles up his face like he never seen anything like Hank before. Then he fetches a kind aggravating smile, and he says, Beneath a shady chestnut tree the village blacksmith stands. The smith, a pleasant soul is he with warts upon his hands. He stares at Hank hard and solemn and serious while he is saying that poetry at him. Hank fidgets and turns his eyes away. But the feller touches him on the breast with his finger, and makes him look at him. My honest friend, says the feller, I am not a preacher. Not right now, anyhow. No. My mission is spreading the glad tidings of good health. Look at me, and he swells his chest up, and keeps a holt of Hank's eyes with his'n. You behold before you the discoverer, manufacturer, and proprietor of Siwash Indian Sagraw, nature's own remedy for Bright's disease, rheumatism, liver and kidney trouble, catarrh, consumption, bronchitis, ringworm, erysipelas, lung fever, typhoid, croup, dandruff, stomach trouble, dyspepsia and there was a lot more of 'em. Well, says Hank, sort of backing up as the big man come nearer and nearer to him, just naturally bully ragging him with them eyes, I got none of them there complaints. The doctor he kinda snarls, and he brings his hand down hard on Hank's shoulder, and he says, There are more things betwixt Dan and Beersheba than was ever dreamt of in thy sagacity, Romeo. Or there was words to that effect, for the doctor was just plumb full of scripture quotations. And he sings out sudden, giving Hank a shove that nearly pushes him over, man alive. He yells, You don't know what disease you may have. Many's the strong man I've seen rejoicing in his strength at the dawn of day cut down like the grass in the field before sunset, he says. Hank, he's trying to look the other way, but that doctor won't let his eyes wiggle away from his'n. He says very sharp. Stick out your tongue. Hank, he sticks her out. The doctor, he takes some glasses out in his pocket and puts them on, and he fetches a long look at her. Then he opens his mouth like he was going to say something, and shuts it again like his feelings won't let him. He puts his arm across Hank's shoulder, affectionate and sad, and then he turns his head away like they was someone dead in the family. Finally, he says, "I thought so. I saw it. I saw it in your eyes when I first drove up. I hope," he says, very mournful, "I haven't come too late." Hank, he turns pale. I was getting sorry for Hank myself. I see now why I licked him so easy. Anyone could have told from that doctor's actions Hank was as good as a dead man already. But Hank, he makes a big effort, and he says, "Shucks. I'm 68 years old, doctor, and I ain't never had a sick day in my life. But he was awful uneasy too." The doctor, he says to the feller with him, "Louis, bring me one of the sample size." Louis brung it, the doctor never taking his eyes off of Hank. He handed it to Hank, and he says, "A whiskey glass full 3 times a day, my friend, and there's a good chance for even you. I give it to you, without money and without price." "But what have I got?" asks Hank. "You have spinal meningitis," says the doctor, never batting an eye. "Will this here cure me?" says Hank. "It'll cure anything," says the doctor. Hank, he says, "Shucks," again, but he took the bottle and pulled the cork out and smelled it, right thoughtful. And what them fellers had stopped at our place for was to have the shoe of the Nighosses off hind foot nailed on, which it was most ready to drop off. Hank, he done it for a regulation, dollar-size bottle, and they drop on into the village. Right after supper I goes downtown. They was in front of Smith's Palace Hotel. They was just starting up when I got there. Well, sir, that doctor was a sight. He didn't have his duster onto him, but his stovepipe hat was, and one of them long Prince Alfred coats nearly to his knees, and shiny shoes, but his vest was cut out holler fur to show his biled shirt, and it was the pinkest shirt I ever see, and in the middle of that there was a diamond as big as Uncle Pat Hickey's when, what was one of the town sights. No, sir, they never was a man with more genuine fashionableness sticking out all over him than Dr. Kirby. He just fairly wallered in it. I hadn't paid no particular attention to the other feller with him when they stopped at our place, excepting to notice he was kind of slim and black-haired and funny-complected. But I seen now I orter have looked closeter. For I'll be dad-binged if he weren't an Injun. There he sat, under that there gasoline lamp the wagon was all lit up with moccasins on, and beads and shells all over him, and the gaudiest turkey tail of feathers rainbowing down from his head you ever see, and a blanket around him that was gaudier than the feathers. And he shined and rattled every time he moved. That wagon was a Jalopy house to itself. It was rolled out in front of Smith's Palace Hotel without the hosses. The front part was filled with bottles of medicine. The doctor, he begun business by taking out a long brass horn and tooting on it. They was about a dozen come, but they was mostly boys. Then him and the Injun picked up some banjos and sung a comic song out loud and clear. And they was another dozen or so come. And they sung another song, and Pop Wilkins, he closed up the post office and come over, and the other two veterans of the Grand Army of the Republicans that always plays checkers in their nights come along with him. But it wasn't much of a crowd, and the doctor, he looked sorta worried. I had a good place, right near the hind wheel of the wagon where he rested his foot occasional, and I seen what he was thinking. So I says to him, "Dr. Kirby, I guess the crowd is all gone to the circus again tonight. And all them fellers there seen I knowed him." "I guess so, Rube," he says to me. And they all laughed 'cause he called me Rube, and I felt kind of took down. Then he lit in to tell about that Injun medicine. First off he told how he come to find out about it. It was the father of the Injun what was with him had showed him, he said. And it was in the days of his youthfulness, when he was wild, and a cowboy on the plains of Oregon. Well, one night he says, they was an awful fight on the plains of Oregon, wherever them is, and he got plugged full of bullet holes. And his hoss run away with him and he was carried off, and the hoss was going at a dead run, and the blood was running down onto the ground. And the wolves smelt the blood and took out after him, yipping and yowling something frightful to hear, and the hoss he kicked out behind and killed the head wolf, and the others stopped to eat him up, and while they was eating him the hoss gained a quarter of a mile. But they ate him up and they was gaining again, for the smell of human blood was on the plains of Oregon, he says, and the sight of his mother's face when she asked him never to be a cowboy come to him in the moonlight, and he knowed that somehow all would yet be well, and then he must have fainted and he knowed no more till he woke up in a tent on the plains of Oregon. And there was an old Injun bending over him and a beautiful Injun maiden was feeling of his pulse, and they says to him, "Pale face, take hope, for we will doctor you with Siwash Injun Sagraw, which is nature's own cure for all diseases." They done it. And he got well. It had been a secret among them their Injuns for thousands and thousands of years. Any Indian that gave away the secret was killed and rubbed off the rolls of the tribe and buried in disgrace upon the plains of Oregon. And the doctor was made a blood brother of the chief, and learnt the secret of that medicine. Finally he got the chief to see as it wasn't Christian to hold back that their medicine from the world no longer, and the chief, his heart was softened, and he says to go. Go, my brother, he says, and give to the pale faces the medicine that has been kept secret for thousands and thousands of years among the Siwash Indians on the plains of Oregon. And he went. It wasn't that he wanted to make no money out of that their medicine. He could have made all the money he wanted being a doctor in the regular way. But what he wanted was to spread the glad tidings of good health all over this fair land of Ern, he says. Well, sir, he was a talker, that their doctor was, and he knowed more religious sayings and poetry along with it, than any feller I ever heard. He goes on and he tells how awful sick people can manage to get and never know it, and no one else never suspicion it, and live along for years and years that away, and all the time in danger of death. He says it makes him weep when he sees them poor diluted fools going around and thinking they as well men, talking and laughing and marrying and giving into marriage right on the edge of the grave. He sees dozens of them in every town he comes to. But they can't fool him, he says. He can tell at a glance who's got Bright's disease in their kidneys and who ain't. His own father, he says, was deathly sick for years and years and never knowed it, and the knowledge come on him sudden-like, and he died. That was before Siwash Injun Sagraw was ever found out about. Dr. Kirby broke down and cried right there in the wagon when he thought of how his father might have been saved if he was only alive now that that medicine was put up into bottle form, six for a $5 bill so long as he was in town, and after that $2 for each bottle at the drug store. He unrolled a big chart and the engine held it by that there gasoline lamp, so all could see, turning the pages now and then. It was a map of a man's inside organs and digestive ornaments and things. They was red and blue, like each organ's own disease had turned it, and some of them was yaller. And there was a long string of diseases printed in black hanging down from each organ's picture. I never knowed before there were so many diseases nor yet so many things to have them in. Well, I was feeling pretty good when that show started. But the doc, he kept looking right at me every now and then when he talked, and I couldn't keep my eyes off in him. Does your heart beat fast when you exercise? He asks the crowd. Is your tongue coated after meals? Do your eyes leak when your nose is stopped up? Do you perspire under your armpits? Do you ever have a ringing in your ears? Does your stomach hurt you after meals? Does your back ever ache? Do you ever have pains in your legs? Do your eyes blur when you look at the sun? Are your teeth coated? Does your hair come out when you comb it? Is your breath short when you walk upstairs? Do your feet swell in warm weather? Are there white spots on your fingernails? Do you draw your breath part of the time through one nostril and part of the time through the other? Do you ever have nightmare? Did your nose bleed easily when you were growing up? Does your skin fester when scratched? Are your eyes gummy in the mornings? Then, he says, if you have any or all of these symptoms, your blood is bad, and your liver is wasting away. Well, sir, I seen I was in a bad way, for at one time or another I had had most of them their signs and warnings, and hadn't heeded them, and I had some of them yet. I begun to feel kinda sick, and looking at them organs and diseases didn't help me none, either. The doctor, he lit out on another string of symptoms, and I had them, too. Seems to me I had pretty nigh everything but fits. Kidney complaint and consumption both had a hold on me. It was about a even bet which would get me first. I kinda got to wondering which. I figured from what he said that I'd had consumption the longest while, but my kind of kidney trouble was an awful SLY kind, and it was liable to jump in without no warning at all and just naturally wipe me out quick. So I sorta bet on the kidney trouble. But I seen I was a goner, and I forgive Hancock his orneriness, for a feller don't want to die holding grudges. Taking it the whole way through, that was about the best medicine show I ever seen. But they didn't sell much. All the people what had any money was to the circus again that night. So they sung some more songs and closed early and went into the hotel. Chapter 4. Well, the next morning I'm feeling considerable better, and think maybe I'm going to live after all. I got up earlier and Hank did, and slipped out without him seeing me, and didn't go nigh the shop at all. For now I've licked Hank once and I figure he won't rest till he has wiped that disgrace out, and he won't care a durn what he picks up to do it with, nother. They was a creek about 100 yards from our house, in the woods, and I went over there and laid down and watched it run by. I laid awful still, thinking I wished I was away from that town. Pretty soon a squirrel comes down and sets on a log and watches